Accession number 22624, Rule 1.
Ray Ashton, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Streatham. I was born in Streatham in South London.
Which year was this?
1925.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Streatham?
No. So we lived in Brixton for a while. My grandmother had a big house there, and which Wynne Road, but the last time I looked in Wynne Road, I didn't recognise it. But we had a flat in her house. And then we moved to Thornton Heath, to a new house. I grew up, for the most part, in Thornton Heath, which is a suburb of Croydon, really. And there I had about 36 years in the Scout movement and met and married my wife, Peggy. And it was there when I was 17 and a half, I went off and joined the army, but pretty much my father's disgust.
And the war had already started then?
Yes, I was about 14 when the war broke out, and we did, as scouts, we did various jobs. We erected indoor shelters, you know, the old tabletop shelters, I forget what they called them now. Quite heavy work, really, for young lads. I mean, it was... These girders were quite hefty things, you know, about 9-inch corner girders with a metal plate on the top, you know, for people who hadn't got Anderson's outside.
Why did the scouts do that?
Well, they did a lot of voluntary work like that. I worked in the hospital, local Croydon General Hospital, and they had their own group of volunteer scouts there. We did fire watching on the roof. We rolled bandages, and I can remember one night they had an air raid. And they brought this woman in on a stretcher. And the sister said to me, "I just wanted to sit there and hold her hand. She's expecting a baby." I was sort of a young 14 in those days. No, I didn't know too much about babies or how they got there or where they came from, really. I suppose I've probably got the basic ideas, but that's about all. And but nothing really much happened, so I was let off the hook. But we did all sorts of jobs there. We had the switchboard, and I remember one horrendous night during a raid, putting a number of incendiary bombs out on the roof, throwing them off the top of the roof and this sort of thing, and sandbagging them.
Whereabouts was that?
That was at Croydon General Hospital. But I suppose after they put explosive devices in them, we were taken off that job, and they wouldn't let us do that. So, but when I think about it, it was a conglomeration of buildings, and some cases I can remember putting scaffold planks from one building to another, and going across these planks with buckets of water and stirrup pumps and goodness knows what, which now, I wouldn't have the nerve to do it now. I look down and I think, you know, surprising really what you do as a young lad. You don't feel fear, do you? Not like you do when you get older.
Would girl guides do it as well?
No, girl guides did do war work. They did, but mainly things like collecting silver paper and waste paper and that type of thing. And I dare say they did some of the more sedate things in hospitals, perhaps rolling bandages and that type of thing. But they didn't have, so far as I'm aware, certainly none in Croydon General Hospital that did fire watching and that sort of thing, you know.
Was there any kind of reward to the scouts for doing it?
There was a badge called the National Service Badge, which you had to do so many hours of national service to earn, which was a red oblong badge you wore just above your pocket, like a medal ribbon, and it had NS on it and a crown in the middle. I don't know where mine is, long gone, I suspect somewhere, but we were awarded the National Service Badge. And we have won. Chap in Croydon who got the Gilt Medal for Bravery, which is the highest scout award. Now, he was on the switchboard at Croydon General Hospital when it was badly knocked about, and he carried on operating his switchboard with the whole side of the building missing. So he earned his. Yeah.
But no monetary reward?
Oh, no. No, they were all volunteers.
How was the voluntary work organised?
I think Mainly, simply by the... He joined the Scout Group, the Croydon General Hospital Scout Group, which was an affiliation of the Scout organisation. And it was just run by the hospital basis. We were under the charge of the sisters on the wards or in the casualty department or wherever, you know. So.
And how was the work erecting the Morrison shelters organised?
Oh, we've simply done that off our own bat, just as little groups. We were told which houses to go to, and we were given a list of houses that needed these things erected, and off we went in the evenings and put these things up. And I can remember on some occasions seeing great big healthy blokes sitting by the side of the fire reading their newspaper, and they didn't even lift a finger to help us. Which is, a bit of an eye-opener. but we were keen, we were young, and keen, and then trying to do our bit.
Who gave you the list?
I don't really remember, but I suspect it was probably our scoutmaster, who was a fireman. He was even a fire brigade, Croydon Fire Brigade. So we didn't see an awful lot of him during the war. He was taken elsewhere, very busy. But
were the Morrison shelters easy to erect?
They're not very complicated, but they were heavy work because they were held together by sort of half-inch bolts, nuts and bolts, and that type of thing, you know. And they had a sort of spring base inside them, as I remember, where to put the mattresses on and so forth. But they were quite sturdy things and quite very heavy.
When Chamberlain declared war on Germany, did it mean much to you?
Not a great deal. I think as a lad, I didn't really... See, my father had been in the First World War, and he became a Peace Pledge Union man. He was a great... and he didn't want to know, you know. And in fact, I always wanted to go in the Navy. That was my real ambition, to go in the Navy. I went and stowed away on one occasion with another scout friend of mine on the old General Steam Navigation ships that used to lay up by Tower Bridge. And, of course, we thought they were great ocean liners. They were little old coasters, in point of fact. And they only went between the Tyne and Tower Bridge with coal. But that was the SS Stork, I remember. But it was quite strange, really, because we were going off to sea, so we packed our kit bags and we scarpered out the back window one night and disappeared up to town on the all-night tram. And we got on board this thing by going down some steps and climbing on these lighters. And having got on the thing, of course, we'd read in all the best Percy Westerman books that we were stowed away in the lifeboats. Well, as I remember, it only had two, but we stowed away in this thing. And we hadn't been there more than about 10 minutes, with footsteps along the deck and a torch shone in there. Come on out. We stood out of this thing, and it turned out that a policeman standing on Tower Bridge had actually watched us get on board. Come down there and woke the watchman. But my father was none too happy, because he had to come and collect us on the all-night tram, and he got to go to work in the morning. He was not best pleased.
But was this before the war?
No, this was during the war. Yes, sure. Well, there have been, I suppose, perhaps 1940, perhaps. I can't remember exactly what year it would have been. But he wouldn't let me go in the Navy. And then, of course, when I was 17 and a half, old enough, I was actually been in the Home Guard for 6 months. So in an Albury Home Guard. And our sergeant was the father of a pal of mine, and he'd been in the First World War in the Lanner Regiment. And he was our sergeant, Sergeant Bird. That was the 62nd Norbury Home Guard. And they used to meet in what was, I think, a Catholic girls' school, or may have been some sort of a convent or something, which is now destroyed and blocks of flats where it once stood. And then, as soon as I was 17 and a half, I went down to the recruiting office and joined the army.
What kind of things did you do in the Home Guard?
Oh, I was a signaller. They wouldn't let me have a rifle. They didn't think I was old enough. I guessed I wasn't of age anyway, really. But because I'd been to scouts, I'd learnt semaphore and Morse. And so I was made a signaller, but quite who I was supposed to signal to. As far as I know, there was nobody else that knew semaphore or Morse. But I had a bicycle, a set of signalling flags and a bayonet, but no rifle. So quite what I would have been expected to do had Jerry invaded. Not to, but I think the fear of invasion was over by then anyway.
Did they meet in Norbury?
Yeah.
Whereabouts?
They met in this convent or this school. It was in the main road, it was, actually. And I can't remember the name of the place. But it was right by the side of, but near Warwick Road in Norbury. Now blocks of flats where it once stood. But when I joined the army, I had to turn up in my Home Guard uniform. That was one of the things, if you remember the Home Guard, you reported for duty in your Home Guard uniform. So we done foot drills and this sort of thing, you know. And I can't remember doing very much, to be honest, but...
Did your father try to influence you about the Peace Pledge Union?
No, but he was anti-war after the first. He was at Vimy Ridge with the Canadians, and I think he had a pretty rough time of it, but never spoke about it much. And when I joined the army, he was a bit upset, and he said, "What have you joined?" And I said, "I've joined the Middlesex Regiment, Dad." I said, "But they're not foot soldiers. They drive around in Bren carriers." And he looked at me a bit sceptically, and he said, "Well, I suppose a second class ride's better than a first class walk." But of course, I mean, we were basically infantry, but we were carrier-borne infantry. So.
Was he an activist in Peace Pledge Union?
Oh no. It was just I think he just joined, and you know, he was in favour, obviously, of. I think there was a lot of feeling about that sort of thing after the war. You know, I think folks had they'd seen at the end of the war, you know, the results and nothing another. Oh yeah.
And I think you were telling me earlier that he'd emigrated to Canada.
Yes, he went to Canada at 13 in the Empire Immigration Scheme, and he had the option of going either to New Zealand, Canada, South Africa was another one. He was very interested in South Africa, and then for some reason he decided on Canada. And when he went out there, they were allocated a portion of land. I think it was something like, would it have been 40 acres? That sounds an awful lot. But then Canada's a big place, and maybe it was 40 acres. But and if they worked this successfully for 4 years, it was theirs to keep. And they were given a certain amount of hand tools, I believe, and seed and this sort of thing. But of course, it was just an area on a map. And they didn't really know what they were going to get. And the chap that he went in with, because some of them joined, go away, Dusty, come around here, that's a good girl. And he joined up with another chap. Quite a number of them worked in pairs. They found it easier to work in pairs rather than on their own. But his area was just a strip of prairie with no water, no trees or anything. The other chap had a certain amount of timber and a creek or some such thing. And they sort of shared, and they built a hut, only a hobble really, of turfs, I believe, and timbers, and a turf roof. And they survived the winter, God knows how, but they survived the winter. But when the summer came, the crops simply dried up and burnt. There was no rain. They tried to fetch water from the creek with buckets, and it was just a forlorn hope, really. They had no chance. And so they packed it up and went their own ways. And he went off and he worked on farms, ranches and so forth around all over Canada, and Calgary and Edmonton and in the Rockies. And then he joined the army. He went to Vancouver. I've since been there. I've actually found out where he boarded the troop ship to come to England. He went to Vancouver, where he actually bought a standing strip of timber. But then there was a forest fire, and he lost it all. So he joined the army then, and came back to England with the Canadian Army, where he looked up his family and relatives, and met my mother. And of course, it went on from there. And then he went off to France, and subsequent to that, was discharged in Canada. My mother went out there, and she went under the auspices of Salvation Army, because there had been a lot of girls being abandoned once they got there. You know, there was nobody there to meet them. And in the meantime, my father had been involved in an accident, a train accident, quite a serious train accident at the time, and was in hospital, right, with a dislocated hip or knee, I'm not sure which, where he spent his savings, just over $100, with hospital bills, and came out virtually broke again, you see. Meantime, supposed to have met my mother. He'd sent her a letter and told her to go to some friends of his in Winnipeg. And these friends would look after till he duly arrived. And he shot off down to Okanagan Valley, which is a great fruit growing area, fruit picking, because there you can make money quickly and you know, by working hard. And subsequently joined her in Winnipeg. The Salvation Army sort of got in touch with them, I believe, and found out it was a bona fide case of, you know. And he joined her in Winnipeg, where they were married. But she got homesick, and of course they came back to England. Well, he didn't, there was nothing he knew here that he could do. I mean, he'd been used to working on ranches and with cattle and you know, these big farming areas. And so he was at a bit of a dead loss. They went to lived in Streatham, and his brother-in-law had a business around Plumstead and Woolwich, office cleaning and window cleaning and all that sort of thing, and a number of men working for him. And he gave him a window cleaning barrow and one thing and another, and started him off with a window cleaning round. And that's what he became, and he was a window cleaner for the rest of his life. He walked miles and miles, I know, his round stretch from Brixton and Streatham and all over the place, Herne Hill. He was a worker right up to the day he died.
What was his name?
Wilson Ashton.
Now, coming back to your own story, can you tell me what the Blitz was like in Thornton Heath area?
Oh, pretty grim, really. I can remember we had an Anderson shelter, but of course there was only room for four in it, and I had a sister and a brother who were both younger than me and my parents, and they went down the shelter. Well, I hated the shelter, and I didn't go down it. I used to go around and see what I could do. And where we were, there was a corner, Pawson's Road, which was twice blitzed, one by landmine and another occasion by bombs. And a friend of mine, this is rather strange, a friend of mine lived in the adjacent road, Canaston Road, and a bomb fell in there, which is not recorded. We've tried to find it, there's actually no record of it in Croydon. But it fell in the road, and it was one of four. I was standing in our porch at our front door, and I heard the thing come over, and I heard these bombs come down, and I heard three whoops. And then explosion, and the explosion was actually in Canaston Road. And two roads back from Canaston Road, which is a split second, I suppose, in a bomb release situation, there are a series of allotments, and then the grounds of an old workhouse. And I suspect on the other side of the road, there's a cemetery. So I suspect those three bombs that I heard are still down there somewhere, either in the cemetery or in the allotments. But three didn't go off. And I distinctly heard them come down, and the woof, woof, woof as they went, and the last one exploded. But it was it exploded very deep, blew the gas main and the water main, and it was a deep crater, but not terrifically big. And it only damaged the houses on one side of the road. The other side, apart from blast, you know, the glass and so forth. But apart from that, there was no structural damage to the houses on one side of the road. But that bomb was never recorded. Now that was about what. 25 yards from us. My sister lost her best friend in the bombing at the road just behind us. They were all killed when the house was demolished. And it was pretty grim at times. But we used to go around and see what we could do. And I had a friend of mine, and I remember going up to the they hit a landmine. They had a landmine hung up in a tree at the old people's home, which was Queens Road Homes, and they had an enormous tower in the middle of this old block. It was an old workhouse originally, and it was a water tower with a big tank on the top. And this landmine was swinging from the tree, and as I understand it, what I can remember of it, they tried to rope this thing so that it, you know, wouldn't swing, and then it slipped, and off it went, and took a number of people with it, and of course killed a lot of the occupants of the home. Now that would have been, I would have thought, about 1941 or late 40 perhaps. And I can remember helping to try and clear away the rubbish with the rescue blokes. And a thing I thought was a cassock, and it was a moonlit night. And what I thought was a kneeling cassock, I lifted it, and it turned out to be the ears and head, top half head of a body, which was a bit of a shock. But it's strange, because as a young person, I think you take these things in your stride much more than you do when you're older, you know. Perhaps it's because you've got too much to think about, and, you know, you don't have time to sort of consider these things too much. But, and then there was an old girl there, trapped underneath this thing, and they were working on getting her out, and she said she wanted a drink. So one of the rescue blokes said, go see if you can find her a drink, lad. So off I went, and there was a dairy up the road, a chap standing in the door. And I said, there's a poor lady down there, she wants a drink. So he gave me a pint of milk, and I got back, I got a volley of abuse. I don't want any bloody milk, she was saying. What she was after, of course, something stronger, I think. But she had a bottle of milk. It's little things like that sort of stick in your mind, you know. No, she hadn't got it. The last thing she was thinking about was a bottle of milk, I think.
How did morale generally stand up to the bombing?
Oh, very good, I think. I think there was a great deal of the attitude being, I've heard differently on the television, which rather surprised me. The attitude amongst the people I came in contact anyway was Hitler can get lost, and, you know, this time we hammered him back. I think the early part, we were dropping leaflets on him, which brought a great deal of derision from the people I knew anyway. They were blooming leaflets, and I think they felt that our chaps were risking their lives going over there in aircraft to drop blooming leaflets, you know. They'd started the thing after all, you know. You weren't going to influence them by dropping a few leaflets on them. But, I think it was remarkable, to be honest. I think, you know, the feeling was that they all pulled, everybody pulled together, they helped one another. And we saw just a brief bit of this. This village was cut off during that bad snowfall.
The village you're living in now?
Yes, yes.
It's called
Barham, and there's a steep hill in that direction, and another one that one, and steep snow drifts. There was a coach with snow up to the roof along there, and the only way they could get anything to us for a few days was on the river. They used to bring a boat up the river with bread and milk. And that sort
this
of
is the Medway.
Yes, which was collected from there and then distributed. And there was a wonderful spirit abroad in the village. Just for that period of time. So, underneath, I think it's still there. You know.
Did you think the Germans might win the war?
I really didn't think. As a young lad, I think we were so impressed with their empire and their army, we didn't think there was anything that was going to stand a chance, you know. Literally, we realised, until we actually got there, when I look back on it, and I think of our home guard, with me, my bayonet and my bicycle, was going to stop the SS, it's a bit of a joke, really. Because when we finally landed in Normandy, we realised how efficient and well-trained the German army was. They were experienced and tough, and you know.
Would you listen to wireless at that time?
Oh yes. Now that's another thing, you see. In those days, we had the Forces Programme and the Home Service, and they were the only two radio stations. And so everybody listened to the same music, everybody listened to the same programmes, and you didn't have this culture difference that you've got today amongst the young people. And we all sang the same songs. We all listened to the same entertainers, Itmar and so forth, you know. Whereas today you have this difference in culture where, I mean, it's like a foreign language to me, this, the music they play today. I'm afraid, you know, it's incomprehensible. And the noise, discos leave me cold, I can't stand that.
Would you listen to VIP speeches at that time?
We used to listen. I remember Churchill's famous speech, "Blood, Tears, Heels and Sweat." I can remember hearing that. And I think too, I think as the war went on, my father's feelings about the Peace Pledge Union modified somewhat. He wasn't so quick to sort of take people up on things. I think he felt that we were involved in a war, and this, and the Germans had actually, and were to blame for it. But of course, in those days, we knew nothing about the horror camps, you know, the Holocaust, or any of that was unknown to us. We had no idea that that sort of thing was going on. And yeah, I mean, the worst propaganda you could possibly. I don't think it simply wouldn't have been believed if the powers that be may well have known about it. I suspect they probably did. But I don't think we'd have believed them if they'd have come in. It seemed all far too far-fetched, you know.
Can you tell me about going into the army now, please?
Yeah, I joined up on the 11th of November, 1942. And I elected to join the Middlesex Regiment. And the reason I did is because a friend of ours, he was the father of one of our the guides we knew, he was in the Middlesex Regiment, and he had an MM and bar, which is, we thought was quite unique. But in fact, when I later got in touch with our old secretary, who's now dead, and asked him about it, he said there were actually 40, I think it was 46 or 48 MM and bars for the Middlesex Regiment in the First World War, which is amazing, really. I was quite surprised at that. I know that MMs were more prolific in the First World War than they were in the Second. And I think that probably more deserved in the conditions in which they served. I mean, they're horrendous. I can't imagine living in the appalling conditions they lived. I mean, some of the efforts we had were not too clever. I mean, we were living in a hole in the ground and this sort of thing. But we weren't up to our knees in mud for months. Although the winter of 44-45, we had some grim times, but they didn't go on for month after month and year after year without moving anywhere.
So how did you go about joining up?
I simply went down to the local recruit. I was an apprentice at the time as a pattern maker, which was actually a reserved occupation. But I felt I was being pushed out a bit. The boss's son was an apprentice, and he used to get all the prime jobs and this, and I felt that I was being sidestepped a bit, you know. And I used to get all the rough old numbers, and I got a bit discontented with this. Well, I wasn't supposed to leave, really. And I went and joined up, took the King's shilling, only for, I was signed on for the hostilities of the war only, you know, hostilities only. And of course, I didn't tell them at work until just about the weekend before I went. I simply said, I shall be in next week. I'm in the army. Well, it was too late for them to do anything about it, you know, otherwise I might have been stopped. But,
what was the firm?
The firm was the Croydon Foundries. And they had a pattern shop there, which was old Bill South, who was the boss man. I don't think he was any too pleased, but because he'd been in the First World War, and I think he thought I was a bit of a fool. Didn't know what I was doing, I probably didn't.
And then, what was the next step?
Well, the next day I took the train up to Chester, where I joined and went to the Dale, where there were actually four regiments there. There were the four machine gun regiments, which was the Middlesex, the Cheshire's, Northumberland Fusiliers, and the Manchester Regiment were the four machine gun regiments. And we'd done our basic training at the Dale, which was for 6 weeks, and then moved to the other side of the camp, which was the 24th Machine Gun Training Centre.
What was the basic training like?
That was fine. It was what we expected. I think sergeant majors were pretty much as we imagined they would be, you know. I can remember the sergeant, who I subsequently found out was a lance corporal when the battalion, the original 1st Battalion, went off to Hong Kong, and he was left behind as IC in charge of the pigs. Apparently he used to have pig sties in those days, and he was left behind as IC pigs. And we didn't know this at the time, of course, otherwise I think we might have let him know. But he was a good drill sergeant, there's no doubt about that, he knew his drill, but he was a terribly ignorant man. I can't give you an example, but he used to get long words in the wrong context, you know, which was hilarious at times. And I can remember him standing in front of us. He was a big blue jowl chap, and we thought he was much older than us, and he probably was only about 28, maybe 30, but he seemed to be so much older than us at the time. And he said, "Now, if you if you're not happy, if your girlfriend's not right and regular, and, you know, you've any complaints, you can come and see me, and I'll see what I can do. If you're not happy with what I do, you can go and see that officer over there in that office. He's your company commander, and you can get an interview. And a lot of bloody good it might do you. Which is a sort of norm, I think. But I think they took great delight. They used to chuckle this kit at you, you see, and we had no idea. I had some idea how to put it together, having been the Home Guard. But it was different equipment from what we'd been used to. And, of course, you assembled it as you thought. Turned out on parade in the morning, and we must have looked some real... quite a circus, I can imagine. And I imagine the sergeants in their mess, you know, had a good laugh at our expense. But, you know, I mean, we weren't allowed out for 6 weeks. And, of course, I had Christmas there.